Hi, good afternoon. Thank you all for joining us on this wet day. I'm Steve Morrison from CSIS, Global Health Policy Center, and we're delighted today to be able to host David Nabarro and John Lang to talk about the status of efforts with respect to avian and pandemic influenza. This is, I believe, the third consecutive year in which we've brought together a representative of the international coordination effort and a representative, senior representative of the administration here in Washington, following the gathering in the last quarter of the year of the leadership to review the status of the efforts at strengthening surveillance and all of the related functions and preparedness efforts globally with respect to avian and pandemic influenza. I think it's very important. The media attention may have fallen off, but that, as I think we'll hear today from our presenters, the reality of this persists and the reality of much effort to bring this forward. We've asked both of them, both David and John, to speak to what came out of the most recent gathering in Sharm el-Sheikh. What were the major issues? What were the points of consensus? What conclusions emerged out of that, and what lies forward? When we get into the question and answer, I would also like to invite comment from David Nabarro also on the global food crisis, which is part of his portfolio also as the Assistant Secretary General of the UN, responsible as the coordinator for avian pandemic influenza and the global food crisis. I also hope at that time that we can, as questions come forward, we can invite some comment from some of the other administration officials who are here. We have Dr. Joe Anelli from USDA, Dr. Dan Miller from HHS, and Andrew Clements from USAID, and we're thankful that you've joined us. Let me just quickly introduce our two speakers and then turn to David, who will kick this off, and then John for further comment. David is a physician. He began his career working for the British government with a special focus on third world developing countries in the field of medical care, moved from there to WHO with a special focus on crisis settings, distinguished himself in that role in many places, most recently in the Darfur, Sudan setting, and the 2004 Indian Ocean earthquake and tsunami, and what followed in the, throughout the course of 2005. In September of 2005, was seconded from WHO and appointed the senior UN system coordinator for avian and human influenza by the Secretary General. So we've been very advantaged by having his continuous leadership in that role now for three consecutive years. John Lang is known to many of you. He's a distinguished American diplomat. He leads the U.S. government's engagement to help prepare for and respond to outbreaks of avian influenza and the threat of a pandemic. He comes to this with a long and distinguished career, working in the Inspector General's office as one of the first deputies in the Office of the Global AIDS Coordinator, as a senior official at the Foreign Service Institute, as ambassador to Botswana, as deputy chief of mission in Dar es Salaam in the late 90s during the period of the Al-Qaeda attack upon our embassy, for which he was singled out for his skilled leadership and extraordinary courage at that particular moment. And he had a long tenure in Geneva where he managed the U.S. humanitarian refugee assistance. So he comes with a remarkable background. Both of these gentlemen have had very distinguished careers that blend the public health, the scientific, the humanitarian, and the diplomatic. We're very grateful to both of you today for everything you've done and for coming and being with us today. So, David, welcome.
Well, Stephen, first of all, thank you for those incredibly generous words of welcome. It's really good to be coming back to CSIS now for this third consecutive description of where we are, because not only am I coming and having an opportunity to share with an interested audience, but also Stephen and the team here have maintained a consistent interest in this issue, partly for the biomedical reasons that it's a serious threat to humanity, but also because of the different institutional approaches that have been used to try to tackle it. I'd like to pay tribute to John Lang and to the many colleagues that John works with for the effort that they have put in to the whole issue of avian and pandemic influenza, and to acknowledge that in this audience there are people who also have worked a lot with me over the years from the United Nations system and from the World Bank, and even from other backgrounds as well. And it's lovely to see you all here. Now, I'm going to try to share with you the story that we've been involved in, the evolving story around avian and pandemic influenza, and the way it's evolved into 2008 and this year. I'm going to convey to you that we have achieved a great deal, but the threat of a pandemic is still there. We will have an influenza pandemic at some time, and we still have to be sure that our people and institutions are prepared for it. I'm going to talk to you about the extraordinary worldwide mobilization that we've seen in response to that threat, and the way in which governments, regional and international organizations have worked together in partnership to prepare for it. A partnership that we couldn't have achieved through some kind of external direction or legislation, but a partnership that's held together through the common interest and concerns of a large number of people. I want to share with you how civil society and the private sector have been working on this issue, and the way in which several organisations, including some represented in this room, have helped to catalyse that engagement and to sustain the movement that brings together these different groups. I want to touch on some of the challenges that we've faced in ensuring transparency of information and even of the sharing of biological materials that's so important for preparedness. And then to summarise for you some of the evidence we've got of improved national capacity to address both avian influenza and a pandemic, and to deal with this as an issue that goes far beyond the health sector and has the potential to affect all of society. So that's the general theme I want to pursue. I've got a few slides that I'd like to share with you. And Stephen, I've noticed that it's out of focus, so if you won't mind, I'm going to try and focus it, or perhaps somebody else.
Maybe we can get on it.
Have we got, probably it's a remote control focus. It's only just a sign of my age, you know, that I actually have to have these things absolutely spot on in focus, otherwise I've had it. We have been worried about highly pathogenic avian influenza for some time, because we know that influenza pandemics, which have the capacity to cause massive suffering and hardship, tend to occur as a result of a mutant form of bird flu or avian influenza that gets into the human population and has the capacity to spread widely and cause major death and suffering. And we've been dealing with one particular kind of highly pathogenic avian influenza really from about 2003 that has been moving in bird populations across this part of the world from Asia into the Middle East, into Europe and into Africa. Fortunately, not into the Western Hemisphere. And this highly pathogenic avian influenza, H5N1, has the following characteristics. Firstly, it's extremely virulent. Secondly, it is able to survive asymptomatically in a number of different bird species, which means that it is capable of continuing to circulate even when we think we have eliminated it. Thirdly, it is capable of infecting humans and causing disease in humans. a characteristic which makes us worry that if it undergoes certain kinds of genetic change, either mutation or reassortment, it has the capacity to start moving from human to human and to cause a pandemic. And there are some who say, well, you've been dealing with this bird flu virus from 2003 to 2008 fairly intensively, and it hasn't yet mutated to cause a human pandemic. What are you fussed about? The answer is, history shows us that it's actually these viruses with which the human race is cohabiting that are capable occasionally of causing diseases in humans that we should be worried about, because previous pandemics have occurred as a result of mutations that may have taken place 8, 10, 15 years after humanity first came into contact with the bird flu virus. So the lesson is, this very dangerous and horrible and killing virus is still potentially a threat to humankind, could well be the cause of the next influenza pandemic, and therefore requires us to treat it with much respect. Now, we've really done a lot throughout the world to try to get on top of the bird flu virus. We still get episodes of infectivity that worry us. For example, at the beginning of this year, Bangladesh became an epicenter, together with an outbreak also in West Bengal, just next door. For the last 2 years, Indonesia has been a cause of concern because the virus has been spreading in between poultry and also occasionally affecting humans, particularly in Western Java. And then we remain concerned about southern China, particularly on the border with Vietnam. And also, we've got some concerns about the Vietnamese-Thai border. And we remain exercised about what's happening on the Nile Valley and in Nigeria. But by and large, the rest of the world has been able to get on top of bird flu. This year, we've seen outbreaks, particularly, as I said, in Bangladesh and in Indonesia, continued outbreaks in Vietnam and on the Vietnamese-Chinese border, some outbreaks in Egypt. There's a particularly ready environment for the spread of avian influenza along the Nile Valley, and then occasional outbreaks in Nigeria and in Togo. But by and large, there has been a great improvement in the capacity of governments through their veterinary services to identify and respond to the bird flu virus, and also a great improvement in the capacity of health services to deal with human cases as well. So now, we've been at regular intervals bringing together the governments that are involved in this work, together with international organisations and a number of regional and non-governmental bodies, to focus on the challenges posed by avian influenza and the potential for a pandemic at conferences on a nearly annual basis. And when I say we've been bringing together, I put the we really as a combination of the United States and a number of other countries that have together formed an international partnership on avian and pandemic influenza, together with the European Commission, and together with the United Nations, the World Bank, and other international bodies. I'm sorry, this is a picture of me. We wanted to have a picture of the Sharm el-Sheikh conference, but the only one we could find had a picture of me in it. Perhaps you've got a picture with you in it. I should have shown that instead. This was a great conference because the government of Egypt said we'll host the conference, but also asked for us to help to make sure that it happened. And it served as a stock take of what countries are doing in relation to both the bird flu problem and preparing for a pandemic. And you see, it's a conference that comes, as I've said, at the end of a succession of conferences, and I think we'll go on having them, in which we can take stock. The first of these was in Washington in October 2005. Paula Dobriansky was the person who had the idea of bringing nations together in a partnership to address avian and pandemic influenza with resources that came from the US government. The partnership was launched in October 2005 in a meeting, I think it was in the State Department. And then in Beijing in January 2006, at a rather larger affair, the partnership was involved in the pledging of really quite a lot of resources, around $1.9 billion for action on avian influenza and pandemic preparedness. Then at the time when the virus really was giving us a lot of cause for concern, we had a stock take in Vienna, and at that time we gave much greater attention, it seemed, to the importance of communication and involving the community in efforts to try to prepare for a pandemic, and also to the broader aspects of pandemic preparedness that go beyond the health sector. In Bamako in December 2006, in cooperation with the African Union, the partnership looked particularly at some of the issues faced in Africa, both for dealing with the avian influenza and preparing for a pandemic. And then we had a landmark meeting in New Delhi, a very large one, attended by over 100 countries, in which, as I'll explain in a minute, a roadmap was produced. And that was then followed by the even bigger meeting in Sharm el-Sheikh, organized by the government of Egypt, with its focus very strongly on pandemic preparedness and where we go next on avian influenza. Now, in New Delhi, we worked very closely with the government of India, and a vision and roadmap was produced, which called for a number of specific steps to be taken by all countries. And these were actually summarized by Stephen in his introduction. Preparing for an effective response, surveillance and response capacity in health services, both animal health and human health, greater biosecurity in livestock rearing so that these viruses don't get a chance to get embedded in different animal groups. I've already mentioned the importance of communications, the effort to ensure human health security by building up on the international health regulations, and then coordination so that we all work effectively together, international organizations, regional bodies, and national organizations, and making sure that we're committed to act. And in Sharm el-Sheikh, in the meeting that took place in October, we took stock of progress against that New Delhi roadmap. We've developed a sequence of progress reports. We've got copies of them for you, which describe an analysis of what's happening in countries in response to avian influenza and assess the state of pandemic readiness. These reports are produced jointly by the United Nations and the World Bank. And this latest report, which has been developed together, is, we think, our best. We are still going to go on producing them, because it's using these reports that we're able to benchmark country performance and we're able to assess progress. There's been some independent validation by the international system of aspects, particularly of national pandemic preparedness and also of bird flu response capacity. And we're particularly pleased that this report does show significant improvements both on the bird flu side and on pandemic preparedness in the majority of countries. Planning for pandemics is now near global, but we are worried that not enough plans are being put to the test through simulations. We are worried that there's insufficient multisectoral involvement in planning, and we still are concerned that the animal health services and aspects of human health services in too many countries are substandard. So despite the fact that we've seen pretty good progress, there's still some worries that we have ahead of us. During the Sharm el-Sheikh conference, where we had statements from more than 60 ministers who were present, we had participation from more than 300 delegates, we were able to distinguish three different areas that now need to be slightly separated and given particular emphasis. The first is to continue the hard effort into which your government has been particularly involved and shown major leadership in trying to ensure that the world is prepared to mitigate the social, economic, and political impact of an influenza pandemic. This requires work within countries, work among countries, and work from the international community. It calls for big engagement of communities, particularly through non-governmental groups and the humanitarian agencies, but it also calls for a lot of work by governments and the private sector. Secondly, we have to sustain efforts to control and eventually eradicate H5N1, sorry for the typo, especially in poultry. And thirdly, we want to see longer-term action to respond not only to the threats of highly pathogenic avian influenza, but other emerging infectious diseases that are going to come from the animal kingdom at the interface between animals and humans in different ecosystems. These three strands of work require global action, require efforts from individual governments, and require mobilization of professional groups, an activity in which all of you here in this room have, I'm sure, been engaged to some extent, but particularly the US government through the work that's been funded from, that have been approved by your Congress, and which has been handled through a number of different departments, and particularly the United States AID, and also some of the groups that have been received funding from other sources, notably CDC. You've all been moving on this. And your Department for Agriculture has been particularly active on the H5N1 eradication activity. Now, we have been benefiting not only from resources from the United States, but from other donors. The United States is still far and away the major donor. And we've had some pledges in Beijing, in Bamako, in New Delhi, and Sharm el-Sheikh that have led us to a point where the cumulative pledge for activities in relation to avian influenza and pandemics has reached $3 billion. Now, some of that money is loan money, at least $1 billion. The grant money is being very quickly spent, and our analysis suggests pretty effectively spent, and we are going to need to maintain the resources so that we're able to continue the effort. So we'd like to see, over the next few years, the effort on avian influenza and pandemic preparedness to be sustained. It's very tempting to stop it. It's very tempting to say we're not getting that many more cases, human cases of H5N1. Why do we need to bother? And there's always competing pressures for expenditure. And we're saying, well, actually, this is one thing that we cannot afford to stop, because the impact of a pandemic in terms of lives lost, in terms of economic cost, perhaps up to $3 trillion, is just too great. So we have to continue to sustain the trend, but recognize that pandemic preparedness has a lot of impact. It goes way beyond the pandemic area and into this broader concept of one world, one health, or diseases at the animal and human interface. We want to be sure that despite the uncertainty around when pandemic hits, that governments will keep prepared. And we want to be sure that in these challenging times, when there is difficulty with continuing to mobilize funds, when there are changes in administrations, that we reflect and we learn and we rededicate our action, and we don't at all run the risk of perhaps losing what has been gained. I'd like to really pay tribute to all of you in the US government for the leadership. It's just been really extraordinary. And I think that when history is written, and when we do have the next pandemic, and we see that the world has been better able to withstand it, it will be clear to all that one of the major influences on that was the efforts of the United States government and people in this room, particularly John Lang and his team. And I hope that it will be possible over the next year or two to keep it up, so that as we go into our next annual conference, which will probably be in Vietnam in 2010, we will be able to say we have continued on the path that we've proceeded on so well for the last 3 years. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Steve. Very much appreciated that introduction, and thank you, David, for your comments. The Global Health Policy Center is quite an impressive operation, I have to say, and I want to give Steve Morrison great credit for that. And David Nabarro continues to be the global leader on the issue of avian and pandemic influenza. The conference that took place, as you heard, in Sharm el-Sheikh, hosted by the government of Egypt, but co-sponsored by the International Partnership on Avian and Pandemic Influenza, known as IPAPI, was the sixth and largest of these conferences. I think that's quite striking that there's a bit of a sense out there of what the Egyptian health minister has called flu fatigue, and one of his stated goals in hosting this conference in Sharm el-Sheikh was to fight that because of the importance of the issue. And he and his Minister of Agriculture, Baza, both succeeded in fighting that fatigue by having the largest conference ever on this subject. The interagency United States government delegation that went to Sharm el-Sheikh really mirrored the approach that you will find in our national strategy for pandemic influenza that has been in existence since November 2005. The National Implementation Plan was issued in May of 2006. In that strategy, the Department of State coordinates our international engagement involving several U.S. government departments and agencies that were on the delegation and are also represented here today. The U.S. Department of Agriculture, Department of Health and Human Services, Department of Homeland Security, and U.S. Agency for International Development among them. The Undersecretary of State for Democracy and Global Affairs, Paula Dobrianski, led our delegation. And the fundamental question that we ask ourselves and that I assume you're asking is, why do governments and international organizations continue to hold these international conferences that cover the two issues that are really distinct issues, the spread of avian influenza in poultry, which has infected some humans, but the numbers are small, and the pandemic preparations? Why do that when we still haven't had a pandemic for the last several years? And you heard Dr. Nabarro answer that in some respects, and I'd like to bring in some other aspects of that. The World Bank in October issued a report that estimated that a severe pandemic, and these are their latest estimates, they had some that they produced earlier, could kill 71 million people around the world and push the global economy into a major recession that would cost over $3 trillion. In May, at the World Health Assembly in Geneva, the World Health Organization Director General, Margaret Chan, described pandemic influenza as one of three threats looming on the horizon, the other two threats being the food crisis and climate change. And the UK Cabinet Office, Prime Minister Gordon Brown's office, concluded in August, after a lengthy study, that the most serious risk facing the British public over the next 5 years is not terrorism, it's pandemic influenza. And this is, of course, a country that's had significant experience with terrorist attacks. The idea is, when you look at the probabilities of a pandemic, and no expert, including Dr. Nabarro, will tell you that in percentage terms, but we know it's going to happen someday, we just don't know when. And then you take the magnitude of it, especially if it's a severe pandemic, and the impact of that, and it's just devastating. It's not like an isolated attack that occurs in terms of terrorism, where a bombing may take place and people are killed, and it's a very sad and tragic event, but it does not spread. This spreads. This would reach every community in the world. And if you have it of the nature of the 1918 pandemic that occurred, you could have 1.9 million Americans dead, barring any mitigating measures that would be taken, just based on the 1918 percentage of Americans who died, one out of every 150 people. As you heard from Dr. Nabarro, with all of these, this threat in mind and the continued focus on the part of the international community, the participants in Sharm el-Sheikh addressed three main challenges. One is focused on the human health, ensuring that we're doing our best to, around the globe to mitigate the effect of an influenza pandemic or another unforeseen catastrophic epidemic. The other one is on the animal health side, sustaining the efforts to control this highly pathogenic avian influenza virus that has been spreading, especially in poultry, and eventually to eradicate it. And then the third is, I think, something that really while it existed in some respects before this scare from the H5N1 virus came about, it's really been accelerated because of this, and that is a cooperation between health ministries and agriculture ministries, a cooperation between the animal health experts and the human health experts. And we explored this to some extent in the discussions in Sharm el-Sheikh in terms of responding to infectious diseases, not just H5N1, but really driven by that scare, but looking more broadly at infectious diseases that emerge at the animal, human, and ecosystem interface, and though, with a particular emphasis really on those that are capable of causing severe damage and affecting livelihoods. As part of the conference, the government of Egypt presented its vision for the future. Copies of that are available here. And that, I must say, did include some discussion of the importance of expeditiously resolving issues that I'm sure many of you have heard about on the sharing of influenza virus samples, the sharing of benefits that derive from those samples, such as pre-pandemic and pandemic vaccines. And it urged a quick resolution of this at the next intergovernmental meeting on pandemic influenza preparedness that is going to take place at the World Health Organization in Geneva in December. But the issue itself was not on the agenda of the conference, primarily because it is being dealt with in another forum through the WHO process dealing with all the member states. And the next meeting, will, as I said, will take place in December. There was a clear consensus among the delegates that this threat is quite real and that much, much more needs to be done to prepare for a pandemic, and that we really did need another conference on this. I doubt that these conferences will go on forever, or at least in the current form, but certainly there was a consensus in that room with all 120 governments represented that we needed to have this discussed again, and it is likely that the government of Vietnam, as you heard, will be hosting the next conference probably early in 2010. The two main focuses now are really this multi-sector pandemic preparedness that we've been talking about. And then the other one is moving more toward this emerging infectious disease approach, which the Wildlife Conservation Society first dubbed as One World, One Health, and that's become more and more a watchword for that. One of the highlights from this of this conference was the success in terms of bringing in additional funds. The Undersecretary for Democracy and Global Affairs, Paula Dobriansky, announced a new U.S. government pledge of $320 million. That brings the total pledge of international assistance for avian and pandemic influenza since 2005 on the part of the U.S. government alone to $949 million. With new pledges that were received from Japan, Norway, and others, the cumulative international pledges since that Beijing conference that occurred in January 2006, mentioned by David Navarro, the cumulative international pledges are now over $3 billion. Two of the themes that we had in our in the our presentations were one about community mitigation and how one can deal with a pandemic in terms of minimizing or at least trying to minimize the impact in a community without the benefit of vaccines. Because that's one of the things that people easily think in terms of, well, why don't we just have a vaccine? The problem, of course, is that you can't create the vaccine until you have the virus, and the virus hasn't mutated to form the pandemic yet. We don't have the pandemic. We have avian influenza. We don't yet have a pandemic influenza from this particular virus. Once the mutation occurs, it'll take 5 or 6 months before we can produce a vaccine using the current egg-based technology. In the meantime, CDC has done a lot of work that has that tries to help communities to mitigate the impact of this through social distancing, closing schools, closing work, trying to have people telework if possible, which obviously works in a developed country, not so much in developing countries, et cetera. And if you go on the basic U.S. government website, www.pandemicflu.gov, you will find a big explanation from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta on community mitigation. Steve, could you please hand me that green number? Sure. At the conference, and we also have copies of this available, we gave out this U.S. government pamphlet called The Global Response, Avian and Pandemic Influenza, The Global Response. This pamphlet includes a section in here on limiting pandemic impact on communities, and it's really just a digest of what you would find in much more detail on the CDC website, but it's really something that we're urging countries all over the world to do, because especially in developing countries where vaccines may not be as readily available even when they are produced, we are trying to urge them to prepare to try to mitigate the impact through efforts that do not involve pharmaceutical efforts. The other thing, and I'm glad that Ron Waldman from USAID is here, in case you have any questions on this, is an emphasis that we placed on helping countries in the humanitarian response to a pandemic. As I've put it, just in broad terms, you could have tens of millions of people die in a pandemic, and you could have millions more die from starvation during a pandemic, because you may have disruptions in the food pipelines. In fact, if it's a severe pandemic, you're very likely to have disruptions in the food pipelines. And for anyone who has visited protracted refugee operations in rural parts of Africa, as I have, you realize that that food pipeline is quite fragile even in the best of circumstances. And the idea that there could be disruptions is quite serious. And so USAID has been working with others in the U.S. government and with international organizations, particularly the World Food Program, with the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies, and with many others to try to deal with various measures, not just limited to food, but various other measures that one can do, vaccines, pneumococcal vaccines, et cetera, that one needs to implement to try to minimize the humanitarian impact of a pandemic that could occur in many developing countries. Basically, we have developed a system over the last few years, and it's a bit of an ad hoc system. It's not institutionalized in one UN agency. It's one that involves many UN agencies, coordinated by the UN System Influenza Coordinator, Dr. Nabarro. We've got an international partnership on avian and pandemic influenza that consists of governments cooperating very closely with the international organizations, and the governments are hosting these conferences. All of these conferences were really, the six that you saw and listed there were hosted by governments. And this has worked. It's really brought an unprecedented level of cooperation among health ministries, agriculture ministries, and foreign ministries. It's the kind of thing that really needs to continue. The U.S. Has provided funding that has really led international efforts in more than 100 nations. And if you look, almost all countries now have pandemic preparedness plans. But as you heard from David Nabarro, many of these plans have not been tested. And it's my view that no nation, including the United States, is truly prepared for a severe pandemic. So what it amounts to, given the threat, given the potential impact of a severe pandemic, which would be huge, the event of our lifetimes, really, wherever you look, from North America to the globe, much more needs to be done. And we hope that we can continue this focus as time goes on. And again, there will be another conference taking place, probably in Vietnam, probably in early 2010, to maintain that. Thank you.
Thank you, David and John. I'm going to raise just a couple of issues, and then I'd like to ask our presenters to speak a bit and then come back to you for some further comment and questions. There's a couple of things that jump out. I mean, here we are several years beyond SARS and beyond the high point of interest in avian influenza. It's not that surprising that there would be some fading of the media interest and fading of the financial contributions. Having said that, it's striking that the Chinese Chinese being so central to the effort, they don't figure in your comments about financial contributions. In terms of sustaining the financial contributions, it's overwhelmingly the U.S. that's there. And why is that? Related to that is, what are the implications looking forward of the global financial crisis as you look at this? What is that going likely to do to your strategy and your efforts in this next year and beyond? Because you've got 14 months or so before you get to your Vietnam conference. We're going to go through a rough patch. Certainly this week's news was not promising. We do have the summit begins tomorrow. We have the Secretary General and world leadership here talking about these issues. So putting it in that context, what's your strategy? On the virus sharing, the story that's been told, which is not much progress on getting resolution of the virus sharing with the Indonesians, that was pretty much the same narrative from a year ago. So has anything changed? And why is it that the issue seems to be languishing? Is it because there just is a continued standoff and this is a personality or institutional-based problem, or do we need a higher level of effort, or is it relatively inconsequential and tolerable that we have such a thing today that sort of continues to just sort of move along? You mentioned one last closing thing. You mentioned that preparedness is, I mean, I take away that there's been a lot of exertion, there's been money pledged, preparedness, there's been some movement forward, but then you're both very cautious in not saying where are we on the spectrum of the aspirations that were laid down. Are we, you know, 6 years into this, are we at the 30% point of preparedness or 60? You know, where are we as you set your markers down to report on progress? How would you estimate that? So those are several big issues. David, you want to begin with some of those?
Thank you very much. Good. It's always that's a good start. The Chinese have made an extraordinary contribution of many, many millions of RMB to this issue by procuring and then making available enormous amounts of vaccine for the immunization of poultry so as to get the avian influenza under control in their own country. And they've also provided quite a lot of vaccine to other countries, including Vietnam, including the Koreas and so on. One of the difficulties about the way in which we count up the money is we are focusing in our reports primarily on overseas development assistance, and we don't find a way, or we haven't found a way, of calculating what's been spent by nations for dealing with their own problems. I would also really wish in public to commend the progress made by the Chinese Ministry of Agriculture and their veterinary services in getting much better quality of data moving through from the provinces to Beijing. We have a strong FAO team in China working closely with the national authorities, and we see a big step forward. John will talk a little bit about virus sharing. All I would just wish to stress is that this is an area in which I do hope that we will see continued efforts towards resolution, and I actually do also see some progress has been made, and John will summarize that better than me. In terms of where we are on preparedness, well, it's very patchy. There are some countries that are really much better prepared than others because they've done very detailed preparedness exercises. Australia, Singapore are two examples. There are some sectors that are much better prepared than others. The financial sector, the tourism sector, tend to be better prepared because tourism was hit by SARS and the financial sector has been hit by other crises, and both realize the importance of getting themselves prepared. We find that militaries tend to invest more and be better prepared. And we've also found that countries that have been affected by bird flu, not surprisingly, will invest more in pandemic preparedness. Where are we? Well, the trouble is we're on the record, and people like myself get very nervous of saying things when we're on the record. But I'm also known to be incredibly outspoken on these things. And I would say that we are somewhere around 40% of where I'd like us to be. Why only 40%? Answer, because there are still a lot of countries that are finding it very hard to mobilize the necessary governmental resources to get prepared for a pandemic. But these are also countries that are finding it hard to mobilize the resources to get prepared for other kinds of disaster. And so what we're actually focusing on here is the challenge of getting precious time, energy, and often cash invested in preparedness for any kind of major disaster that is going to have significant impact. However, I will continue to argue that this is worthwhile, given that the likely cost of a major pandemic is at least $3 trillion for the world economy, to be spending an amount that is possibly around $500 million a year on preparedness, and that is quite a lot of resources and will contribute to considerable action, is not an insignificant amount. And we have a number of plans ahead for use during the next 12 months to make sure that we drive up towards a level of preparedness that, at least from my analysis, would be near a 60 or 70%. Because then I think we're really beginning to feel that we are getting under control. Now, when you say what's the implication of the global financial crisis, I'd in a way like to put the question back to you. If you were in a position of authority when able to determine the allocation of resources during a global financial crisis, would you say, we can cut back on airline passenger screening because of the global financial crisis? We will just have fewer baggage inspectors and perhaps only screen one in three instead of every passenger? Or would you cut back on the effort to try to make sure that there is not the importation of noxious beetles and other such things in vegetable matter that comes in through your borders? Answer, you wouldn't. You would maintain, because these are essential pieces of national security, essential pieces of local security. We feel exactly the same must be applied to pandemic preparedness. This is a vital element of personal health security and human security and national human security, but we know we may have to fight to make this point. Thank you.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, Sid. Some very thoughtful questions, Steve. The financial issues, I think you can find the U.S. government, probably better than almost all other governments, has incorporated this whole effort into the regular appropriations process. It started out as supplemental appropriations from Congress in 2005, 2006, and now USAID in particular, but also USDA and HHS and others have been able to get strong congressional support to continue this because of the importance of it. So right now, you can look at the U.S. government perspective on this, and we're quite hopeful that there will continue to be such support. But, of course, things have changed given the world's economic crisis. But it falls really to what David Nabarro was saying. How can you not prepare for something of this magnitude? The U.S. government approach with the whole panoply of threats that face us at this point, our approach is all hazards preparedness, and this is an element of that. We can be prepared for some anthrax attack and other biosecurity measures. We can be prepared for nuclear attacks, radiological, et cetera. This is one. It's not an attack from that's generated by humans. It's naturally occurring, but it would be just devastating if it occurs. And if you look at it in terms of all hazards preparedness, this is one of the things one needs to prepare for. So the case, it seems to me, to be there, and we're hopeful in terms of the finances, even given the financial crisis. When you ask where are we on the spectrum of aspirations, it's the first time I've heard the term 40%. That's the news item out of here. I can see Dr. Nabarro. It's actually not a bad number.
Is it a surprise to you, John?
No.
You don't have to say a number. I'm just asking.
No, I don't. I don't disagree with the number, but I don't want to say what I would say the number is.
Okay. John Lang says 40%.
No. But much, much more needs to be done. The thing about a pandemic is the second and third and fourth order ramifications. And that's where you can find, and I think you can even find some people in the United States government who look at things that we've done, but then you realize how complicated things are. If you listen to Dr. Michael Osterholm from the University of Minnesota at SIDRAP, he will talk about the pipelines in a just-in-time economy. And maybe we have enough ventilators, but we don't have all the parts for the ventilators when you need replacement parts. And those come from China, and we only have a few days in storage. And so, therefore, you have to have the pipelines going. In fact, one of his arguments is that one of the most important groups of people you need to give the vaccine to, once you do have a vaccine available, are those who are operating the freighters that are carrying all the goods across the oceans that keep economies going. If we all knew that this pandemic were going to begin on July 1st of 2009, we would be acting differently. We would have our last wills and testaments written, updated. We would have all kinds of things done if you knew that it was going to happen. And you don't know when it will happen. You also don't know if it will be severe. One of my other fears, if you look at it from the flip side, is that a pandemic occurs and everybody starts believing, well, this is 1918 all over, and overreacts. And then you have a mild pandemic that's a little worse than the seasonal influenza. I had a call from my alma mater, and Steve, yours, the University of Wisconsin, at one point when they were doing some studies as to when do you close a university. When do you close a university of 40,000 students for a semester? That's a huge cost. And if you do it and it turns out it's a mild pandemic, you may have done far more harm than good. Again, this is where you look at the thoughtful effort being done by CDC. They came up with something called the Pandemic Severity Index that gives you a range of 1 to 5 in terms of how severe the pandemic is, 5 being as if it were a stage 5 hurricane, which for these purposes is 1918 level of pandemic, and that will help guide your actions. Before that creation of the Pandemic Severity Index, it was really people kept talking about 1918 or 1957 or 1968, the three pandemics that were that occurred in the last century. Now they think more in terms of this rating of 1 to 5. Finally, let me mention the virus sharing and sample sharing. This has gone on almost 2 years now, as you point out, and you can hear discussions that seem to be the same ones we've been having. Ever since May of 2007, the World Health Assembly passed a resolution then that has guided this operation, this process. The resolution was number 60.28. It's on pandemic influenza preparedness. But the process is a long and cumbersome one. We very much hope that the December meeting that's coming up is the last meeting in this process. There are two efforts that are going on. One is to continue or resume as soon as possible the sharing of samples of influenza viruses with human pandemic potential, the virus sharing side of it. The other side of it is making progress on defining a package of benefits that would be provided to developing countries on a voluntary basis, on a multilateral basis, but so that developing countries would not be disadvantaged during a pandemic. I can give some specifics if anybody's interested in terms of outcomes that we expect from the December meeting, but it is a very frustrating process. We have a wide range of views out there. There are some countries that want to bring in broad concepts from the Convention on Biological Diversity and areas that are really not appropriate in the mind of the United States and many others for a pathogen. This isn't something that you want to keep and preserve as for biological diversity. It's something you want to kill. It's a pathogen. And as one op-ed piece in the Washington Post in August described it, viral sovereignty, as seems to be claimed by one or more countries, is really not appropriate for an influenza virus. So we're still at loggerheads on this, but we're hopeful. We have a lot of soundings, a lot of discussions with other governments right now, and we're hopeful that we can come to resolution in December. The verdict is still out.
Great. Thank you very much. Let's collect some quick comments and questions. Judy, please identify yourself and then offer a quick comment and question. Thank you, Judy.
Judith Kaufman, I'm an independent consultant who's worked on global health issues and these issues in the past. And thank you, Steve, for organizing this again, and thanks to John and David for being here. I want to broaden the vision a little bit, too, because You talked about flu fatigue. You talked about the longer-term action to respond to emerging infectious diseases, broadening the scope. We know that there is, I think it's fair to call it a crisis of health systems in many, if not most, parts of the developing world. And I'm curious about what's being done to ensure that pandemic influenza preparedness, avian influenza preparedness, helps strengthen rather than weaken health systems, and whether information is being collected on how this is being done so other vertical disease-specific programs can in the future also strengthen rather than weaken.
Great. Other questions, comments? Back in the rear here. Yes, sir. There's a microphone there.
Hi there, from the School of Public Health, University of Maryland. Dr. Navarro, we were together in June last year in Rome. And at that time, you didn't say what the percentage of the progress that we made, but this time you said 40%. I like it. But I don't know what are the specific indicators you have to say 40%. One of the important indicators is trust from the farmers, particularly in the developing countries. How far we have done in order to recompensate or compensate the farmers, because they're the key people who can actually stop or reduce the mode of transmission of the virus. And it is, I know it is the responsibility of the national governments, but also it has lots of influence from the donor side and from the other stakeholders who are involved in this kind of pandemic influenza.
Thank you. Do we have other comments? Here's one in front.
Good afternoon. Brian Armstead, Voice of America. I'd like to know if changing climate patterns have had any impact on, you know, if global climate change has had any impact on the spread of avian flu.
Hi, Miriam Estrin from Brookings. I was wondering if you could talk about potential other disease threats to the U.S. that threaten our security, maybe drug-resistant TB, and whether these efforts take into account other threats and what those other threats are.
Okay. Why don't we come back to our speakers. David, why don't we start with you? There's four questions on the table there, whichever of those that you feel are most appropriate.
Thank you very much. There are others in this room who are better qualified to comment on most of these things, and I hope that, Steve, you're, if not bringing them in by name, at least create an open house situation for others to speak. The work that's been done to prepare for both human cases of avian influenza and influenza pandemic has tremendous strengthening potential for health systems, whether it's the development of surveillance capacity, the improvement of laboratory services, the improvement in capacity to respond to disease outbreaks with proper procedure, the application of the international health regulations as a worldwide legal instrument that is used for handling this, and also some of the codes that have been developed on cross-border working, which has really improved a lot in recent years, we have seen fantastic examples of collaboration at regional level and at global level. And this is work that is necessary for any health system anywhere to deal with any kind of infectious disease threat. And I really do believe that this is an example of something that has strong reinforcing capacity. We have a set of indicators on pandemic preparedness that were used as the basis for this report. We drew these indicators from work that's been done by a number of different groups, including the work that's been supported by US government in a number of different settings, the work that's been undertaken by CDC, with their range of indicators on pandemic preparedness and work undertaken in the ASEAN and APEC regional organizations, as well as the European Centers for Disease Prevention and Control. And so my figure of 40%, which is a rounding up from the approximately 35% of pandemic preparedness plans that we find have been subject to test, is why I where that came from, and I therefore can defend it. I would like to see it higher, and that's why I'm pushing for more pandemic preparedness. On avian influenza, I totally agree that people who develop livestock have to trust the authorities to respond in a proper way, and that means firstly not overreacting, and secondly compensating for poultry and other atoms of property that may be killed in the effort to control or destroyed in the effort to control disease. If there's not compensation, it really is very difficult to take forward control programs. And your USDA and our Food and Agriculture Organization have been working very, very hard, together with the World Organization for Animal Health, to encourage the introduction of proper compensation policy. It's not high enough. Again, our report suggests that more needs to be done there. We've got evidence that highly pathogenic avian influenza is transmitted more during certain seasons. Actually, it seems to like cold weather. And we found that, for example, that in the very cold European winter of 2 years ago, there was quite dramatic movement of HPAI and also spread through a number of bird species that were quite surprising. And so there's no doubt that it is a climate-sensitive spread. But I don't think we're in a position to say to you that this particular disease is associated with changing climate patterns like global warming, though there are others that have been identified, and there has been a recent piece of work published in Nature that suggests that there are certain particular ecosystems in which emerging infectious diseases are most likely to come forth from the animal population. We could talk more about that privately if you wish. And then does the approach that we're doing, the effort that we're doing, take account of other diseases that threaten mainland US and also other countries? And the answer is very much so, yes. What we have done is recognize that the work that's been done on avian influenza is very relevant to other diseases that come from the animal kingdom and affect the humanity. And that's why this work that John mentioned, the One World, One Health approach, has led to the development of a new medium-term strategy jointly by a number of international organizations working with the World Bank. And one of our tasks this year is going to be to learn the lessons of work on avian influenza to apply to preparedness for other emerging infections from the animal kingdom. And I hope that this time next year, if we have a chance to speak, we'll be able to show that this has led to much better defense against disease threats that could have a major impact on humanity. Those are reactions to those questions from me, Stephen. Thank you very much indeed.
Yeah, if I could just to pick up on one of those, and then on the compensation of farmers, maybe Joe Anelli from USDA or Andrew Clements from USAID may have some additional comments. But I'd like to pick up on Judy Kaufman's comments and that of others about strengthening, not weakening, health systems. I really have not seen any evidence of a weakening of health systems from having this emphasis on pandemic preparedness. But I think it's clear that one sees the limitations. And for those of us who've lived in sub-Saharan Africa, for example, it's very hard to go to an African health minister and say, yes, your people are dying of HIV/AIDS, and they've got tuberculosis and malaria and polio in some cases, et cetera, but what you really need to worry about is a pandemic that may not occur for years. It's very hard when they have so many immediate concerns. That's why one of the things we're emphasizing, as I pointed out, is this community mitigation guidance that really is meant to come up with low-cost ways of trying to deal with a pandemic through social distancing. But one of the things that I've been very happy about is to, in my travels, is to see that the influx of resources, much of it from the U.S. government, has had a major impact that has gone way beyond avian influenza. Now, if you're talking about the culling of birds in an immediate area around an outbreak, when you try to kill all the birds within 3 kilometers in order to try to stamp that outbreak out, after all your effort, you've gone nowhere. You're just back to zero. You've killed the birds. You've compensated the farmers for the loss, and you're back to zero. That you gain nothing from that. And that so some of this money has been has gone for those kinds of purposes. But the other aspect of this, and this occurred to me, when I was in Nairobi, talking to several of the U.S. government health experts based at our embassy in Nairobi, and they have done a lot in terms of improving the surveillance capacities, the laboratories, et cetera, not just in Nairobi, but in elsewhere in Kenya and in the region because of the regionally based offices there. They've done a lot to improve these, and they pointed out that it's basically using this threat from avian influenza that hasn't yet hit East Africa, but could. It's been close. It's gotten to southern Sudan, but it has not gotten to Kenya or Tanzania or Uganda. That you end up then building up laboratories and capacities, training veterinarians, training epidemiologists, et cetera. So I think a lot of the effort here you can really look to, and we can provide statistics, but in a general sense, it has had a positive impact. And certainly that's helped develop this broader look at One World, One Health that has come out of these meetings.
You know, this question around the 60% gap and how do you begin to cover that? Some of that gets back to, you know, the international health regulations were passed a few years ago, but without a whole lot of consideration around who is going to pay in poor countries to create the capacity and sustain the capacity for this. And it's, you know, there's a pledging process by which money is brought forward, but it's not become the notion of supporting the international health regulations and the capacities in developing countries as a matter of donor assistance strategies, it doesn't seem to me has really become a central facet to the point where you could say, well, the part of the solution to a 60% gap is that gap is largely in countries that are least able to pay for this, and there needs to be a more systematic sort of approach to this. I want to invite, if they wish, Joe Anelli from USDA and Daniel from HHS and Andrew Clements or Ron Waldman to speak, intervene at any point. Please just put your hand up. We'll move a microphone over to you because some of the issues that I think, as David mentioned and John mentioned, some of these issues are ones where your expertise and contributions are quite focused. So please, I want to encourage you to jump in and... let's also move to another round of comments and questions here, down here. Daniel, did you want to? Is that Joe?
Yeah.
Okay.
One thing that might be significant to mention
can
on
you
the...
just repeat who you are? And what
yeah, sorry, I'm Dr. Joe Anelli with U.S. Department of Agriculture. I think something about your question about compensation that's significant to mention is that there really is a transformation that's happening in the way the disease is being approached now. Early on, when there was a sort of panic level to reaction here, stamping out and therefore paying compensation to farmers was a key component of that. If you're in countries that have an advanced veterinary infrastructure and the resources necessary to do compensation, you can stamp out the disease, as Thailand and some other countries have, India, at a great expense. The transformational part that's happening is that people are recognizing that in many of the countries that the disease is currently entrenched or endemic in, is that that stamping out is no longer the appropriate method, that we're moving into a more long-term eradication strategy, or as FAO has put it, a progressive control and eradication approach in which things that would return an investment to those small farmers is more important than paying compensation for disease outbreaks. So it's really becoming the economics of the disease in addition to the human health component that the sort of future of this disease control program is moving in.
Joe, may I just follow up on that? I mean, what you're saying is what you're saying that the evolving thinking around preparedness is that if you have a better system of preparedness, it's not just a question of destroying and compensating animal stocks that have high value for farmers and which are overwhelmingly backyard small-scale farms. It's protecting that investment to the degree that you have nutritional and remuneration and benefits because it's so closely tied. Is that part of the sort of shift of, because in the early phase it was all about there's a contagion present, it must be eradicated, there must be compensation. Mm-hmm. It's a different logic that's now seems to be coming forward. Is that accurate?
I think so. I think one of the fundamental principles that's has been moved forward with that is an improved surveillance system in many of these countries. Through a lot of the work that's been done, countries have moved from essentially no surveillance to a now very active surveillance system that they can more readily identify the first infection. Many of them initially had gone undiagnosed for two reasons. One, people didn't recognize what the disease was, so even though a large number of birds died, they just assumed it was Newcastle disease, another disease of poultry that they have to deal with. The other part of that is they didn't have the diagnostic capability to determine that this was H5N1 avian influenza. Now that they've got both of those, they can approach these diseases more early on in their outbreak. If we use India for an example, as they continued to do surveillance once they identified their first flocks, they recognized that it was throughout all of West Bengal. So each time they expanded their depopulation zone, they would find another area adjacent to it with infected animals. Ultimately, they had large portions of West Bengal with no birds and a rule in place where they were not able to repopulate for 30 days. If you're a farmer, that's significant economic impact. But if you're a family that had two or three chickens that were your only protein source for that coming week, and those birds were gone, you not only don't have the protein source, but you no longer have any source of income to provide that from another area. So that approach is just not going to work in the long term because governments and donors can't sustain that kind of approach.
And how do you win support, and maybe this is something for David and John to comment on also, how do you win support from export industries that, I mean, look at China, for instance, where you have a deep interest in sustaining high exports where there's a contradiction there of you know, destroying your stocks or reporting very honestly that directly threatens your ability to export, generate earnings, and generate employment. And so you're going to have anomalies between your human reporting and your bird reporting on infection rates. How do you bring industry along in that context where there's such strong disincentives to really be fully forthcoming in reporting?
I think that that's probably not a major concern because the industries that are doing the exporting are the larger, FAO has categories. These would be more the upper level type of production. And when they have even small production losses, they report those because they're depopulating on their own, whether it's avian influenza or something else that they're dealing with, so that if they're going to maintain an export market, they're reporting immediately, depopulating immediately, and this is most of the developed nations. The challenge now is most of the countries that are entrenched do not have a significant export market, and therefore there is no economic incentive to become free, because you're not losing a major export market.
Dan, did you want to offer some thoughts? Please identify yourself.
Daniel Miller from the Office of Global Health Affairs in the Office of the Secretary of HHS. Just a couple thoughts to pick up on Ambassador Lang's comments about virus sharing. He certainly described a long process of back and forth and some progress and still a lengthy process. But I also want to make sure we don't lose sight of the other forms of progress that have been made. The foundation and the basis for some of the criticisms of developing countries about virus sample sharing has been the lack of, or the potential lack of access in the time of a pandemic to, by developing countries, to pandemic vaccine. And those complaints began nearly 2 years ago, but we're in a different world technologically in terms of vaccine development 2 years later. The U.S. government has invested nearly $1 billion in development of new vaccines and new technologies that will make better vaccines and vaccines available more quickly, such as through cell-based technologies. The current egg-based technologies are very lengthy. They're very fastidious. It can be a technological nightmare to try to get vaccine quickly. The cell-based technologies really hold the potential for developing large quantities of vaccine very quickly. We're not quite there yet in terms of the technological, the completion of those technology strides, but that holds great potential, and there has been a lot of investment. We're also trying to work through increasing manufacturing capacity in developing countries through a partnership with the World Health Organization. Both Japan and the U.S. have provided nearly $25 million to increase capacity of manufacturers in six developing countries so that they can develop the capacity to manufacture their own influenza vaccine for their own countries and even become potential suppliers of vaccine regionally in their area. The advent of new technologies and new products such as adjuvants. 2 years ago, it was pronounced that there were only 300 million doses possibly to be manufactured of pandemic influenza vaccine if it were to occur in 2006 or 2005. Through the introduction of adjuvants and through expanded manufacturing capacity without adjuvants, we're up to 800 million doses could be manufactured tomorrow. When you use adjuvants, which basically, if you had a vial that before you could only vaccinate 10 people with that vial, through the addition of adjuvants to those vials, you could expand the use of that vial to 100 people. So we're now talking of in the range of 2.5 billion doses that would be available in short order if a pandemic were to be available, were to occur. But we're not there yet. We need 6 billion doses or more. So we need to acknowledge that there's not only progress, albeit slow and long, in terms of the sample sharing discussion, there's also great progress that's being made to address the underlying issue, which is access to vaccine by developing countries.
Thank you, Dan. Andrew Clements, would you like care to offer any comments? You don't have to, but if you do, put your hand up.
Andrew Clements, USAID. I'll just follow on Dan's theme of successes. Comparing 2006, which was the very big year where I think there were 53 countries total that had reported H5N1 infections, the last 2 years have been relatively small, and it seems like the geographic range of the virus is somewhat contracting over the last few years. This may be that 2006 was a fluke because of the weather and other conditions that allowed it to spread around. Maybe the countries were less prepared than they are now, and maybe it's a combination of our preparedness activities and other support to developing nations getting better over the last few years. For whatever those reasons are, or combination, it does seem like the virus has contracted, and that's afforded us the opportunity to focus activities down on a limited number of countries that are big problems. And some of these were shown up here on the map, Bangladesh, Indonesia, Vietnam, China, Egypt, countries like that. So I think as the virus has shifted over time, there's an opportunity to attack it where it is. And then within those countries, we've also started to see that it's not everywhere in those countries. It's in specific places in those countries. And the research that's going on right now is starting to identify particular poultry production within those countries or particular poultry marketing systems within those countries that can be specifically targeted and try to take out the major sources of where the virus is being maintained within the country and then also being spread around the country. So this is one of these things that there is research going on. Our interventions are getting better. We're able to target them a little bit better. So I'm liking the way this is looking. We're not out of the woods yet, but I'm liking the way this is looking in terms of the range of virus contracting, the number of trouble spots potentially decreasing as well. So hopefully this continues to go in the right direction and we don't have another year like 2006.
Thank you very much. We have a question over here and one here. Let's take those. And then we're going to come back to our two speakers for wrap-up. Yes, please.
Thank you to both speakers. My name is Susie Peel, and I'm particularly interested in the intersection with communications, which you've both addressed very much, and community preparedness. And I wanted you to comment on communication to non-literate populations. I was involved with UNICEF, who I believe has the mandate for preparing materials, a year and a half ago, and then it went nowhere. It seems to me we could be ready to jumpstart communication to communities, and that would have to be also to non-literate communities. Thank you.
Yes, sir. Right here.
My name is Sachin Bagre. I'm from Pan-American Health Organization. I have a very basic question. What steps have been taken to make sure that countries are more willing to share information or to disclose initial cases so that the infection could be contained to a particular region rather than it becomes a global problem?
Great. Thank you. We're getting near the conclusion of this particular session. What I'd like to do is come back to David and then to John, ask them to offer comment to the two questions we just had and some of the other interventions. David, also, if you could offer us a quick snap on where we are on the work that you undertake on the global food crisis and what we may see, particularly at the summit, begins tomorrow. And then we'll come to John to wrap up, and then we'll be done for the afternoon. Thank you. Thank you. David.
So none of this work on preparing the world to deal with major outbreaks of infectious diseases can succeed without the full involvement of communities. All the analyses of what happened during the SARS outbreaks in 2003 confirmed that if people are not partners in a major disease control effort, then the state will certainly find it difficult to achieve its goals and may actually fail. Because unless there is partnership, there is suspicion, and that suspicion can easily build up to lead to non-cooperation. I think we have to continue to work very hard to make sure that the different institutions that are responsible for ensuring effective communication do it in an empowering way and not in a way that somehow implies that the receiver of the information is less worthy than the giver of the information. So thank you for raising that point. Obviously, I can't comment on the specific instance that you referred to, but I think your general point is extremely important. To our colleague from PAHO, as you know, we don't have any simple instrument that makes it obligatory on countries to disclose information and provides for international intervention to ensure that that disclosure occurs. We rely on the voluntary cooperation of national governments who retain sovereign control over what happens within their territory. I was involved in the efforts when the international health regulations were being negotiated, and that was very clearly the position taken by many of the governments concerned. I actually believe that the powers available to WHO are still remarkably strong, and there are obligations on a nation, obligations on WHO, when an infectious disease is suspected, and I believe that this is something that we need to continue to pursue through dialogue between governments and the organization responsible, which is WHO. I, again, don't want to get into specifics because that's really the business of Dr. Mirta Rosas and Dr. Margaret Chan. I'd like to just comment on the kind of questions you've asked and also to reflect on this seminar. Both John and I have tried to convey to you our belief that the process underway with regard to avian influenza and pandemic preparedness is a really good example of intergovernmental working in a world where there is no system of global governance. The only way in which we can operate is through the consent and common will of different countries, through the provision of external assistance, and through the creation of a partnership which ensures that there is some reflection on mutual obligation of nations to address issues. As Stephen Morrison has pointed out, there are major difficulties around ensuring that there is adequate financial support for countries so that there is a more equitable sharing of both benefits and burdens. But we've been making progress on this, and I believe that the work that's occurred on the influenza preparedness effort is an example that is worth citing when it comes to thinking about other similar challenges that need this kind of cooperative response. But it only works if there is strong leadership, and the strong leadership has been provided by a number of countries, not just those who provided resources, but also countries like Egypt or India or Mali, who hosted these partnership conferences. And I think we very much depend on colleagues like yourselves who are working in Washington and interacting with national leaders to stress the importance of continuing to provide fora within which this kind of cooperative work can go ahead. And that gives me a chance just to move to talk about some aspects of the international system through which everybody accesses the food that they eat. I don't think it's a surprise to you if I say that there are features of our food systems that are not working very well, particularly for poorer people or people who are subject to various kinds of shocks that restrict their ability to purchase, restrict their ability to access. So when earlier this year, as a result of shifts in demand, particularly the move towards producing fuel from crops because of the rising cost of petrol, and also problems with supplies due to increased costs of agricultural inputs, due also to a number of climatic events, led to an already quite volatile situation for food prices becoming extremely adverse, with a spiralling in prices of rice, of wheat and maize to points where they were double, perhaps treble, even sometimes four times as great as they normally would be. And the impact was absolutely devastating for many of the poorest billion people in our world, who would find that they had to spend double or even more than double the normal amount that they would spend on the food they eat. And if you're earning less than $1 or $1.50 a day as a landless labourer in a poor country, then to suddenly be facing an increased bill for your food when you're already spending 60% of your income on food has just one impact, which is you eat less. Your children eat less. Malnutrition levels rise. Death rates rise. Women-headed households get hit the worst. Households where there is somebody who's got a chronic illness, could be HIV, could be another disease, also get badly hit. It was a really desperate situation, a stranglehold on poor people. It led over a matter of weeks to the number of poor people in our world suddenly increasing from 700 million, poor malnourished people from 700 million to nearly a billion. The reason for this is there are things wrong with the world food system. There are things wrong with the way in which we respond to short-term needs for food. We have a world food program which is facing far too many demands on it with too little resources. And secondly, agriculture, particularly production by smallholder farmers, has just not received adequate investment, particularly in Africa, over the last 30 years. To cut a long story short, the Secretary General of the UN set up an organisation-wide task force of UN agencies, the World Bank, the IMF, the World Trade Organization, the OECD, and a number of other organisations to adopt a comprehensive approach on nutrition, food, agriculture, markets, trade, and social protection. And we've been trying to take this forward. It's another example of an attempt to get different institutions to work together. and that is what I'm involved in. This is not a talk about food, but I just wanted to tell you that even though at Chicago in the grain markets you may see that wheat prices have dropped, or you may find that maize prices are also coming down, the underlying problems in the food crisis are still very much there, and we are extremely concerned that the current emerging global recession will actually increase the number of poor and food-deficient people quite dramatically over the next 3 years. And so one of the Secretary General's messages, if he does get a chance to talk to world leaders, and he's seeing a number of them over the next 2 or 3 days, will be, we've got to manage this recession, but we've got to manage it in a manner that has a human face by trying to ensure that poor people are not in any way disadvantaged as a result of actions that have to be taken to sort out the global financial situation. And we are extremely worried that that will be a hard goal to achieve.
Thank you very much, David. That's very eloquent. John, would you like to wrap up?
All right. Thank you, Steve. And thank you again for organizing this very, very interesting discussion from my perspective. Just briefly, we have a national implementation plan with hundreds of action items. The U.S. government agencies that have been involved in implementing this over the last couple of years have implemented the vast majority of them. They're in place, and it's on the www.pandemicflu website. But as I said, no nation is really prepared for this pandemic. So the central message, I think, is to maintain the focus on the threat. And one of the worst things we could do is go back to the status quo ante, go back to 2003, not have that level of cooperation between agriculture ministries and health ministries, not have this recognition that we really do need to cooperate with, have the animal health and human health sectors cooperating for the benefit of human health, not just for the benefit of animal health. There's really a connection there from the many diseases that have gone from the animal kingdom to humans. And this scare of the pandemic influenza and the threat from the H5N1 virus has really generated something far beyond what was initially thought of as the concern for a pandemic influenza in this connection that, as I said, some call One World, One Health. We think it's important, and we expect the international community through Dr. Nabarro's work, through the conference expected to take place in Vietnam in another year or so, that focus will continue, and we want to help it out. Thanks.
Thanks, John. David, John, we owe you each a debt of gratitude for your leadership and your perseverance through this period, and your superiors, Ban Ki-moon, Paula Dobriansky, who've stuck with this. And we will regroup shortly after the Vietnam conference, I promise you. And please join me all in thanking our two presenters. Thank you. We are adjourned.